talking about here, but the principle is still the same.
Think
we're inserting some problems with mens rea in this code that I don't think that have previously been inserted. Now, the model penal code, definition of criminal coercion, does not use reasonably believed. It says the defendant believed, and there's all the difference in the world with respect to culpability.
Your point is, George, that...
If the defendant believes honestly that he has a defense, whether it's reasonable or not, he ought to have a successful defense.
And
if
then
the jury believes him.
And then it's a matter of proof as to whether he did believe
or
not.
We ought not to litigate something that was not in that particular defendant's mind, not what he should have known.
What this says is if he should have known, why?
Yeah, he should have known here, then he has no defense.
I'll accept Professor Platt's amendment to my motion, but we'll have to go back. If we follow this, why, for the purpose of discussion, but if we follow this, are we going to have to go back into theft and well, the same thing on theft?
What you're saying,
he believed it was his?
It's a basic policy decision. Should we inject negligence into crime? Where should we inject negligence? Where should we say that a man can negligently be guilty of a crime? Model Penal Code says this is not one of the places. In fact, I think the only place the Model Penal Code says it's possible is with respect to the public welfare offenses and the homicide offense like negligent operation of an automobile. Otherwise, it's a rarity in the Model Penal Code, and I think justifiably so. If mens rea means anything, then we ought to relate to the person who's before the particular bar of justice. What was in his mind? And not what should have been in his mind, but what was it actually in his mind?
Well, that goes even too far for my generally defensive-oriented mentality, but you're saying an absolute. What he believes, if he believes, is a defense.
That's right.
Right or wrong.
But remember...
Whether the belief is
if it's absolutely
ridiculous,
the jury is not going to buy it. There is a safety measure.
You say the same thing with reasonable belief. That's a jury question. But
a jury question, but why
it's
should
really
we...
Relevant.
Why should we let the state, this is the question, why should we let the state prove should have?
Because of the impossibility of proving mens.
But you're going to prove it all the time. You prove it all the time. How do you do it, Frank? You prove it by inference, you prove it by, this is what he, now look, nobody knows or nobody would not know something. You convince the jury that it's ridiculous.
Well,
they would have now, by inference, by accumulating evidence, by circumstance. You do it all the time, don't you? Intention, premeditation.
But it's much easier.
We're not trying to make things easier for the state necessarily. We're trying to develop a policy with respect to the application of criminal law.
Didn't you read the election returns last fall?
Should we convict persons on the grounds of their negligent acts, or should we convict them on the grounds of what they intended to do, or what they thought they were doing?
We set up a code of conduct which we must adopt as being standard. And whether you reasonably believe that you are ascribing to the code or not depends on whether or not there's going to be some criminal sanctions imposed to what you do. But to say that I believe, therefore, a cogito ergo sum, I believe that it exists, therefore it exists, and that's a defense, as I say, it goes even too far for...
Well, it's a policy matter.
Yes, it is.
You sort of have to make up your own mind how you feel about the criminal law.
And Frank, I'm frightened again, I agree with you.
Well, George, isn't there a distinction here, though, between drafting a statement of a crime that says, in effect, you are guilty of committing this crime if you negligently do such and such? Isn't that a far cry, though, from saying that you are going to be allowed a defense to a charge, but only if this is a reasonable defense? I mean, isn't...
You can make the distinction, but the end result is the same. You're convicted of murder or you're convicted of coercion. Isn't that right? If you give a man a defense, and the defense is what he believed, what he thought in his own mind, and you don't really let him do that, then you're convicting him on something less than mens rea.
What we're trying to do is place upon the individual some responsibility. Individual responsibility on not only what he knows, but what he should know. that by just closing his mind and ears and everything, he can't go out and do anything. He's got to do some checking, got to act in a reasonable manner.
It comes down to being George, duty is in the eye of the beholder.
George, let's look at it another way and say that we do eliminate that, as the Model Penal Code has. So there's good authority on your side. But assume that the person said, yes, I believe that this was true. And the prosecution introduces letters written to him, confrontation between him and the person involved. Every single solitary thing indicates that he did not believe this. And so the jury says, well, we think that he did, or he didn't, whatever the case may be. And they find him guilty. And yet the man persists, I believe this, what I did. Now, wouldn't you then be convicting, that jury would have convicted this man when he really didn't believe, yet all the circumstances showed that this is
where I would agree with Mr. Frost, that there is a limit, obviously. There is a limit to intelligent ways to approach this. And you've posed a case, certainly, where a jury, no intelligent jury, would believe that he believed. So here's where the reasonable man standard comes in. It's not expressed in the statute, it's just what this jury, as reasonable people, based on the facts before them, will believe about that particular defense.
Well, I frankly just don't feel that it's all that important. I'd go either way because the jury is going to do what feel is right. But
I think the jury is going to do what feel right, but in the back of my mind, and when I look at these criminal statutes, it's not necessarily what the jury is going to do with them, but what the judge is going to do with the motion for judgment of acquittal. whenever you're, if you're dealing only with new rather than or had good reason to know, you're going to get past the judgment of acquittal stage, you're going to have some evidence that the guy knew.
Right.
Now you can get by having good reason to believe, like in the stolen property cases, the situation where we have it now. You can get by the judgment of acquittal by having at least sufficient circumstances there that the judge can say that the person had good reason to believe, at least. There's that question for the jury to determine. And then the jury themselves is going to reach their determination by what they think is right under the circumstances. And this is what I really mean by, say, making things easier for the prosecution is when you're dealing with that judgment of acquittal stage, where if you've got to, this knowledge, you're going to have some evidence of knowledge, not just the circumstances that show that he should have known. At least some judges are going to go.
With respect to the Model Penal Code, now maybe it's I misunderstand their language here, or maybe that they are inconsistent, I don't know which, but with respect to example, George, for ignorance or mistake as a defense. Now, one of the defenses they set out is if the defendant acts in reasonable reliance upon an official statement of the law.
This is a mistake of law, and I'd rather not talk about those kind of cases because I think they're significantly different.
But they're talking about affording a defense, and they're talking about mens rea, aren't they?
And this is one of the very few places where they insert the word reasonable, because it's such a very unusual kind of defense to say that you were ignorant of a printed statute somewhere. That's why I would prefer not to argue my case on that basis, because I think it is so much different than the factual situation of time.
Well, this policy question, let's decide it. We have a quorum. Majority can make that decision. All those in favor of deleting the word reasonably will say aye. Opposed, no.
No.
No. No. George spins the... Now, the motion to adopt Section 7. All in favor will say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion is carried.
George, you won that... you won that one on...
6 months ago.
Well, it's that one on trespass where we adopted the forestry code provisions, and you shot me down so miserably in full commission. forget exactly what that was on.
Remember
that? Was that on arson? I think it was an arson.
Yes, it was arson.
You know?
Never let me forget that.
Huh?
I remember how badly you cut me up for responsibility.
I not only lost that argument here, I also lost the case up in Judge Wilkinson's court.
Now, what's been our practice? Have we been adopting the article as a whole?
I move that we adopt it as a whole.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion is carried. Now we come to forgery.
But that was my fault. I said Wilkinson.
That's why you were shaking your head when I mentioned Judge Wilkinson.
Yeah,
now, this appears in your books as amendments to preliminary draft number 2. Now, this went back to subcommittee, really mainly for the purposes of checking it out, because there is nothing in this, I hope, nothing appears in these amendments that were not recommended by the full commission at its meeting on the 22nd of February.
Covering your tracks.
Now, we've changed language in section 3, forgery in the first degree.
Don, is this a preliminary draft 1 of forgery?
It's no here.
No, this is preliminary draft number 2 of forgery.
If you'll keep turning some pages, you'll come to draft number 2.
Well, why isn't preliminary draft 2 of forgery in my big book? You took it out and put it in here, I guess.
It's in your
black book.
Black book.
Okay. He can yawn us back.
All right. Now, section 3, we have deleted what formerly appeared as subsection 5. We've taken that out, a written instrument officially issued or created by public office, public servant, or government agency. That has been deleted from section 3 of preliminary draft number 2.
Don, excuse me, do the amendments that you have, beginning of the section, does preliminary draft number 2 reflect these amendments?
No.
No.
The no first two pages
two
there are,
two.
Oh.
No, these are just the amendments that appear in your book as amendments to preliminary draft number 2.
There is no section 3 in preliminary draft number 2. This is an added section. I mean, this particular forgery in the first, at least I don't find it.
No, it appeared on page 8 of
page 8.
Preliminary draft number 2.
Yep, yep.
Now, do you remember, why is he going to take a written instrument officially issued and created by a public office, public service, government agency out of court?
Well,
I remember something we were talking about.
There was an example given, a press release, I think was the example that Senator Lent gave that might be officially issued, but that he didn't feel that, you know, that should amount to forgery.
He was anticipating that he'd succeed, right?
Well, now, then I got another question. And do we feel that the public record,
Can I answer your other question now?
Okay.
First, with respect to subsection 5, the written instrument, on page 11 of our minutes of February 22nd, that's where the discussion starts. Continues through page 12.
It's a long discussion.
Oh, I have them right here. Really. I have them.
On page 13, Judge Burns moved to delete subsection 5, section 3, and to have the commentary appropriately show that it is not the intention of the commission to say that it does not constitute a crime, but rather those acts would come under section 2, forgery in the second degree.
Okay.
then we discussed Ford's prescriptions.
Well, whether Ford's prescriptions should come under forgery or they should come under...
Well, the discussion was whether we should specifically spell it out with respect to Ford's prescriptions. And on that, as I informed the subcommittee, I wrote letters of inquiry and sent copies of the drafts of, or the statutes from some of the other states, New York and Michigan, for example, on forged prescriptions. I sent an inquiry to the Oregon Medical Association and the Pharmaceutical Association and inquired of them their views on this. These inquiries were sent shortly after our meeting in February, and I did not receive a reply from either of those organizations. I asked them whether or not they felt that there was a need in our forger draft for specific coverage of prescriptions not related to dangerous drugs or narcotics. So I'm unable to tell you whether they have any viewpoint on it one way or another. But, the subcommittee felt that as much as we did not have any request to specifically include forged prescriptions, that it would be covered anyway, but it wouldn't amount to forgery in the first degree. Now, the next changes we made were to delete sections 4, 5, and 6. Those were the possession types of crimes, and those were moved to for deletion based upon George Platt's suggestion that he felt that they were unnecessary in view of his inchoate crimes draft. This was preparatory to the commission of another crime, and that we did not need separate sections on that.
The possessing a forged instrument, but you're going to presume that it was preparatory to passing?
Attempted forgery. Right.
Now, did not we do this prior to the submission of the inchoate crimes article to the other, to the appropriate subcommittee?
Well, it was in draft stage. The subcommittee had not seen the article at that time.
Okay. Did the subcommittee approve the article, and is there action commensurate with what you expected it would be, so that it's all, so that it takes care of this?
Well, no, the subcommittee hasn't approved the draft yet. It has considered it, and it hasn't. They weren't able to get through the entire draft. We got through most of it, as I recall.
There are four sections that are still not been looked at, but there has been no approval yet, there has been no disagreement that the placement of the inchoate crimes in the proper place. There has been, okay. I assume that it remains to be proper. Now, there was one other question with respect to possession of instruments and possession of deadly weapons, burglars tools that the committee, subcommittee has not discussed, and that was one of the problems that will pervade some of the other areas.
You're going to have some dialogue there about the statute that we've already passed in sub 1 on possession of stolen property, aren't you?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Possession of what?
The policy question is, should you have one possession section?
Right, in the
inchoate
crime. Right.
Possession is an inchoate crime. Should it be treated generally, in general definitional terms, in the inchoate crime section, or should it remain throughout in separate places with respect to completed specific crimes?
And we decided that as to 4, 5, and 6 here, it should be treated generally in the inchoate crime section, but we previously had decided that possession of stolen property should be a separate crime.
I think that decision was made before there was any consideration of the inchoate article.
Later we're going to have to back up and decide on that issue.
The commission will want to back up, and maybe they'll just leave it alone. The subcommittee has not yet arrived at any conclusion on that issue, and would make recommendations to the full commission later.
Okay, so 4, 5, and 6 have been deleted, and then just the mechanical changes, renumber section 7 on page 18 of your draft is section 4. On page 20, section 8 is renumbered as section 5 and is amended. Read, a person commits the crime of fraudulently obtaining a signature if, with intent to defraud or injure another, obtains the signature of any person to a written instrument by knowingly misrepresenting any fact. This was an amendment that was voted on and approved by the commission, mainly because they felt that the previous language was awkward. Language means of any misrepresentation of fact which he knows to be false. Page 22, section 9 is renumbered. Page 27, section 10 is renumbered. And then we get to section 11, and this is where we have the biggest change, probably the most discussion. And that was the section on negotiating a bad check. Now,
page is on
30.
Yeah,
page
that's
two of the amendments. Page 30 of the section.
Page 30.
Oh, that, of course you have.
That was intentional, Dave.
That's funny, neither do I. 28,
29. What's this you're looking for? Page 30.
Yeah. Where section 11 was? It was on page 30.
Yeah.
You got page 30?
Mm-hmm.
I don't have one either.
Ho, ho, ho.
Well, if you want to borrow my page,
I got it easy.
But we've changed the title to the section. Previously appeared as negotiating a worthless negotiable instrument to negotiating a bad check.
You change it to negotiating a bad check?
Negotiating a bad check.
Uh-huh. That's the current wording.
Yes.
Good.
That was your pitch, remember?
People could understand.
Wanted it so that the reporters could understand what was going on in the courthouse.
We did away with the language negotiable instrument and used check or similar site order in its place. The criminal knowledge is the same, knowing that it will not be honored by the drawee. There's no change in that. The prima facie provisions with respect to presentation of the check and the time in which the drawer has to make good the check for the purposes of raising the prima facie evidence that he knew would not be honored is basically the same. Took out the reference to the Uniform Commercial Code definitions that we had in the previous draft.
Now, on section 8, sub 2, as I read this, all I've got to do is to go get a bunch of checks down here at the U.S. National and go out and date them. June 18th, 1969, and run around town and pass them to a bunch of clerks who don't really pay much attention to them, and they give me money or goods for them, and I'm okay, because I'm post-dated.
Well, if it's
present law, what's present law and post-dated? There's a loophole in the present law on post-dated checks, isn't there?
Well, that's a hybrid case, and you can take the position of the present law that, of course, in that individual case, he had him write out 12 checks, so that, you know, dating them for each month, you know, the first of each month, or the 15th of each month, you know, whatever the payment date was, so that then on the 10th check, he couldn't turn around and file charges for NSF check when the check bounced. Because at the time of taking the check, he knew that it was post-dated. So sometimes, under certain circumstances, you get away with the prosecution for NSF check in a post-dated situation. Now, if the person didn't realize it was post-dated, the other person accepting the check, if they could reasonably rely on the check. But under this, I guess it makes a post-dated check a good defense. Does it not?
You mean this section?
Mm-hmm.
Well, what it does, if it's post-dated, it just prevents the... It prevents you from having a prima facie case.
Yeah. On the evidence only.
For the purposes of this section, it is prima facie evidence of knowledge unless the check or order is post-dated. If he had no account at the time the check was drawn. We're not saying it isn't a crime, but we're just saying that not going to raise a prima facie case against him if it's a post-dated check.
Well, I think that if the guy has no account, regardless of whether it's post-dated or not, it's a pretty good presumption that he didn't expect it from the auditor.
How much discussion was there on not even having this law violation?
Rather considerable.
Now, we discussed it at length, as I recall.
Well, pages and pages and pages. We discussed in Ways and Means that all check violations, whether they're felonies or misdemeanors, that the offender should be put in the custody of the Multnomah County Sheriff and not the state.
Not the hell of an idea. Well, I was here, most of them passed on Friday surprises.
So I don't really have anything else to say with respect to this, these changes.
Policy.
Except this was my understanding from looking over the minutes of the last meeting that these were the changes that the commission desired before it took another look anyway.
I need to refresh your memory on that. From the whole question of bum checks, I think we all would have been very comfortable leaving bum checks out of the criminal code, excepting that we needed this. To raise so much hell between the Associated Oregon Industries Retail Division and so forth and so on, when the code came up in the legislature, we never get through that. I don't think anybody here had any great desire to continue this sort of thing as a crime.
Well, I think you're going to get quite an objection from the whole commercial operation, banks and everybody
else.
Yeah. They want checks to be treated basically as money.
Yeah.
And if you take it out of the criminal statute, then you got problems as far as this would be. And the checks won't be able to be cash.
By the time this comes up, we may not be using checks anyway. We may be all be on credit cards for all of them.
Well, if we could rely upon district attorneys to use reasonably good sense, the prosecutions wouldn't have a problem.
You can rely on some district attorney.
For what it's worth, Department, Don, I don't know whether you've read the case yet, but it has implications certainly with what we do when we come to any presumption, and we're going to have some presumptions with respect to possession, and that's the Leary case, and I think that's a beautifully named case. It's not a name, it's an adjective, you know. But there's an extensive discussion of presumption in the United States Supreme Court opinion, and that has, I think, ramifications in any modern criminal law code. Court takes a very jaundiced view of presumptions of any sort. I think this one would be all right under the Leary case, however, because it seems to, the general rule, as I recall, sort of hastily examining that case, was that the fact presumed has to be very reasonably connected with the fact proved. And I think that this looks reasonable to me in this particular case. But we should be aware of that as whenever we start presuming things here.
Well, we discussed, we didn't discuss the Leary case because it hadn't been decided the last week, but we did discuss the question of prima facie provisions, and I felt all along, and I think the commission has felt this, that we should tread very lightly in this area of creating prima facie evidence of guilt or guilty knowledge. And I think every place where we have considered a prima facie provision, we have certainly made it more difficult or watered it down from our existing law. For example, on the question of theft of services, the prima facie provisions under our existing defrauding an innkeeper statute, for example, we have practically eliminated it, except in the case where there's an absconding. As we say, that's prima facie evidence of fraudulent intent. But,
you know, I wonder on the, we could say that we can go back later on and amend by deleting the law, that part of the code deals with NF checks and so on. But I wonder if that's really not shirking our responsibility to be somewhat forward-looking. And I think the greatest opportunity to leave something out of the code is going to be done by this commission, not by the Oregon legislature for some future time. And if there was a general consensus that this really didn't belong there, but it was just expedient to put it in, I wonder if we're not making the wrong decision on that.
We have some other things that are left in because of expediency and having battled away for the Constitution for 4 years, in which we took the tack that we were going to leave out all the, we were going to be forward looking and never were able to get more than 19 votes in the state Senate on it. I
think it's probably the best way to vote, Don. But even so, everyone isn't completely satisfied that we should leave them out. But aside from
I think it was a general feeling. I didn't mean to indicate that everybody wanted to get rid of them right off the bat.
No, I don't think you can.
I
don't think you can because you get the professional hardcore check burglar who negotiates bad checks for a living. Is, my judgment, deserving of incarceration to the fullest degree, even as much as the murderer or the larcenist or whoever. So, the carte blanche say that we can't, that we shouldn't make it a criminal offense, overlooks, I think, an awful hardcore element that.
What it would also mean is that you couldn't carry checks in your pocket. You'd have to start carrying cash or a credit card or something because you wouldn't be able to cash a check.
It's so hard now to cash a check. I don't.
For you it is.
I've
got
carry
it's hard to cash
carry
a check,
two carry credit cards and forget the check. Two credit cards and $10 in cash.
Well, I think the model penal code points out and some of the other states adopt this too, that you could probably eliminate any special statute on bad checks and just have it covered as theft by deception. But they say that the model penal code points these things out. Number one, it says it has the advantage that you don't have to prove that any property was obtained by the use of the check. And also you can have your prima facie evidence provisions in it.
Michigan says that same thing.
I have a question, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah.
I'm going to make a motion that we approve this because we went over this extensively in the commission and these were the specific directives that the commission made when we sent this back to the drawing board and the membership has kind of changed and I think that there was a pretty round consensus, if not a unanimity of opinion at the time we made these recommendations.
Well, I just checked that, John, in the minutes, and these do follow the directions given.
But I wonder, from a drafting standpoint, and looking at the fact that this is what we're writing, we hope will endure for some period of time, that if it isn't kind of sloppy draftsmanship to say here in sub 2 of section 8, for purposes of this section, as well as in any prosecution for theft committed by means of a bad check, et cetera, et cetera. Now, that's if this prima facie provision is going to apply to all of them. Should it be tucked away in subsection 2 of the section dealing with only negotiating a bad check? Just from a structural standpoint. That's number one. Number two, I just looked through our approved draft on theft, and we don't have any crime called theft committed by means of a bad check. The section that we're on here is forgery and related offenses. It's not entitled theft committed by a bad check. So you've got a new expression or term, word of art or term or something here that doesn't crop up in the theft section, doesn't crop up here. And it's confusing.
Where did you get that language?
Yeah.
Theft committed by means of a bad check?
No, in this subject, for the purposes of this section, as well as in any prosecution for theft committed by means of a bad check.
Now that comes from the Model Penal Code, Mr. Chairman. For the purposes of this section, as well as in any prosecution for theft committed by means of a bad check, so that's under section 224.5 of the Model Penal Code.
They got a real problem with that tartan term. You know, those Damon baseball players can't shoot a bat, though.
They never dry it out.
They damage
me. Where is our theft? Look in your, you see if there is. We did have a deal. Do we have a crime that's entitled theft by means of bad check?
No, we don't. We have theft by deception.
Well, then, why would we have this? That's what I mean here. I know it comes from the Model Penal Code, but we shouldn't have it.
Where's our theft by deception?
Well, you might want to say theft by deception, but... All that these minutes said were in other offenses where there's an offense by bad check.
Yeah, no. Our theft by deception is, at least the title of the section is the same as section 223.3 of the
Model Penal Code.
Right, and they don't mention a bad check in there, nor do I think you need to mention it, but as far as that's concerned, as far as the theft section's concerned, and their language with respect to by means of a bad check is the same as we have used, and maybe we're both wrong, but because I think you could refer to it as prosecution for theft by deception, or you could just you could do it two ways. It seems to me you could, after theft, you could say for any prosecution for theft by deception committed by means of a bad check, or perhaps you could eliminate the phrase committed by means of a bad check entirely and just refer to it as any prosecution for theft by deception.
Well, where is it? We can't.
Senator Burns, I think you got a good point there.
Well, when you say theft by deception, then you're inserting a prima facie provision and relating to a separate article in the forgery section. And it's a question of art and structure as to whether or not it belongs here. So,
well, I think it's more properly placed here than it would be to have a separate section under theft.
Well, why didn't you say...
That raises prima facie evidence for theft by a bad check.
Why didn't you say, for purposes of this section, as well as any prosecution for forgery and related offenses? Then it would more properly belong here.
Well, no, that's not...
No, that wouldn't be it, though.
That wasn't the reason we put it in here. Because the only place under forgery and related offenses is going to come into play is under the section with respect to negotiating a bad check.
Well, then why don't we just say, for purposes of this section, comma, and it removes my objection.
Well, because you want the same prima facie provisions to apply if you decide that you want to prosecute the man for theft by deception by means of a bad check.
Well, why don't we just put it there?
Then why don't we put it there? I don't think we should give the district attorney the discretion to, and Frank, please bear in mind, I have a reputation of being very prosecution-minded. I don't think we should give him a discretion to prosecute under this section or under the theft section for the same things. And I think if you wanted to apply in the theft article, well, if I follow what Don is saying, that you do.
No. The idea was...
Can you steal rent?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's defrauding an innkeeper. That's a separate section. Can we pass this? Special statute for that.
Well, isn't this why we have a separate section here at all on negotiating a bad check? Is because there are certain types of things where you write bad checks that it wouldn't come within the theft by deception thing entirely because you're not obtaining property or depending which is theft, don't you have to take some property.
You can give me a concrete, for instance, or to justify it. I'd go along, but I just think that it's wrong.
Well, if you get a dumb prosecutor, and he's
over in Crook County.
He's charging someone for theft by deception. That's what he's prosecuting under, and he forgets to look back at this one. Or he just doesn't. How will he know that, unless the check is post-dated, that it's having knowledge, that it's prima facie evidence that the check would not be honored if these things happen?
Say nothing. Well, especially if he's got a dumb defense lawyer.
Or a dumb judge.
He probably wouldn't, but I don't think Senator Byrne's objection to it that it gives the district attorney too much discretion is well taken because... This, as we discussed at the last commission meeting, was intended to be a misdemeanor sanction.
Yeah, I think that Senator Burns is wrong on that, prosecuting for the same thing, but I All do right. think that this is out of place. I don't mean that it's out of place, but the same thing should be in the other, in the theft by deception.
Is this covered, or is it in
here? Well, if... You're saying that they put this in because this is intended to be a misdemeanor, and you're applying it to theft by deception, where there are felonies. I don't know. I think, Mr. Chairman, that we ought to delete it and have it applied just to this section, and if we feel that it should be, the same provision should be included in the theft article, that it should be placed in there.
I think so
on
too.
Its own.
I'd agree with that. I think that's one of the problems of statutes in general is this
going back and forth.
Going back and forth business that occasionally even certified members of the Oregon Bar have problems with this.
This isn't exactly related. About 2 weeks ago, I was at a funeral and I was talking to a fellow there, and I said, well, old Joe found out that you can't take it with you. And he said, the hell he did. You know, that so-and-so still owes me $200. I'll never take it.
I'll move we strike it and ask that Maxine make a footnote,
check
Don make a mental note to add it to the tentative draft that we've already approved in the appropriate place and bring it back to the next commission or the subcommittee meeting for consideration.
How would you state sub 2 then?
I'd say for purposes of this section, comma, unless the check or order is postdated, comma, it is prima facie evidence, etc.
You've heard the motion. All in favor will say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Carried. Now, what's your pleasure on the whole, on the amendment?
I move we adopt it.
Motion's been made that we adopt the amendments to preliminary draft number 2 as amended here today. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Carried. Don, you've got to vote on something.
I don't have the right page. That's what's been confusing me on this last page. I have one that's badly out of date. Didn't have any of the language John Burns was talking about any of the time.
Look at the very front. Of the very front of the forgery and related
first
offenses.
Third page of the section. Oh, keep going forward. Page before that, just the one page.
There you are.
The first, second, third page.
That's solve the problem.
Could I make a suggestion, Mr. Chairman?
Mm-hmm.
Could I suggest that we defer full commission action on principles of construction, because it's obvious we're not going to get through everything that's on our agenda today, and Judge Burns is the chairman of the subcommittee that worked on that. He isn't here. Is this not correct, Don?
Yeah. Professor Arthur's a reporter, he's not here.
Yeah.
And
Can we go on to...
Go on to general definitions, and if this wouldn't impede you, it might help our discussion if he were here to help lead that.
Well, Professor Arthur is going to be unavailable for the rest of the summer because of eye surgery. And the reason that these were put together on the agenda under Article 1, this number 4 under your agenda ties in with number 6, and that's a question of whether or not we can stop with the sections we have drafted for our Article 1, our preliminary article. And if the Commission does decide that some of these other provisions, such as statute of limitations and the jurisdiction of the court and whatnot.
Don, let me ask you this. Did Judge Burns approve of this preliminary draft number 1 on principles of construction, the subcommittee?
Yes.
Well,
actually, I don't, every time I say this, something happens, but I think as we look at this, we'll see that it isn't too controversial.
All right. Well, I'll withdraw my suggestion.
So, Don, why don't you take off?
All right, now.
And don't come back for a couple of days.
I may not. This sets out the objectives of a revised code, and really is very similar to the statement of the principles set out in the Model Penal Code. Professor Arthur noted in his commentary that his section is based on Michigan Revised Criminal Code, Illinois Criminal Code, Article 1, Section 15 of the Oregon Constitution, and on ORS 161050, and also on the Model Penal Code, Section 1.02. He felt that the Model Penal Code was a little longer than it had to be, and
the draft that Professor Arthur formulated includes deterrence and protection of the public.
I was going to ask you.
That these statements appear in the New York and Michigan proposals, but don't appear in the model penal code or in the Illinois statute. Probably a good idea if we read through this.
Could I ask you one question before you can do that? How come it starts with section 2?
Well, that's a good question. I do have a good answer.
All right.
That is, this is part of a general article on preliminary provisions. And this will appear as section 2 in that article. This is not an article in itself. This is a part of an article.
I see. All right.
What starts in section 1, Don?
Section 1, says, Senator, says that any antisocial act is punishable as a crime. I didn't want to send that along to the commission.
Well, you know, for a non-member, you sound like a former Senate Judiciary Committee.
Well, I spent about 10 years attending those kind of meetings in Illinois. So that's right.
No, Section 1 is a section we might not need. But it's reserved at this stage for a short title. Now, we may want a short title for this because it will be a long bill. We're not required to have a short title. We can if we want. I have a short title that I've drafted and I haven't presented. But
all right.
This is not. We want to wait till some afternoon when we're tired.
Oh, no. There are a number of titles we could give this. Generally, and the Legislative Council's office recommends that normally you don't have a short title. But there are exceptions, and one exception is in the case of a long bill that in effect is establishing a code, and that for the purposes of convenience you can state that it be referred to as the Oregon Revised Criminal Code or the Oregon Criminal Code of 1971.
Okay.
The Turi Code instead of the Deedes Code.
Yeah.
All right, now the general purposes of this code are to forbid and prevent conduct that unjustifiably and inexcusably inflicts or threatens substantial harm to individual or public interest. B, to give fair warning of the nature of the conduct declared to constitute an offense and of the sentences authorized upon conviction. C, to define the act or omission and the accompanying mental state that constitute each offense and limit the condemnation of conduct that is criminal when it is without fault. D, to differentiate on reasonable ground between serious and minor offenses. E, to ensure the public safety by preventing the commission of offenses through the deterrent influence of the sentence authorized, the correction and rehabilitation of those convicted, and their confinement when required in the interests of public protection. F, to prescribe penalties which are proportionate to the seriousness of offenses and which permit recognition of differences in rehabilitation possibilities among individual offenders. And G, to safeguard offenders against excessive, disproportionate, or arbitrary punishment. Now, with respect to subsection 1, I should mention this, that there was a statement made in the subcommittee when this was considered, and this was considered only once by the subcommittee, and it was approved, but the statement was made that perhaps E should be listed as number 1. In other words, E moved up to A, and then A and the subsequent subsections or paragraphs redesignated. And there was a feeling or expressed that to ensure the public safety by preventing the commission of offenses should receive precedence in order of listing under this subsection. But the draft has not been changed now, but I did want to call it to your attention. The rule that a penal, and then under subsection 2, the rule that a penal statute is to be strictly construed shall not apply to this code or any of its provisions. All provisions of this code shall be construed according to the carrying point of their term, to promote justice, and to effect the purposes stated in subsection 1 of this section.
What does that mean?
The subsection 2, what does it mean?
Yeah.
Well, it means that the courts in the
determining what the intent of the statute is, that they will not apply the common law rule, that which was that a statute in derogation of the common law shall be strictly construed, and that a penal statute is not to be strictly construed, but that it is to be construed as near as the court can determine to prohibit, say, the type of conduct that apparently the legislature is trying to prohibit.
Or if they invent something tomorrow that we don't know about today, but it seems to fall within the general confines of something else, it would be covered?
Well, yeah. Now, our present statute, 161050, has very similar language to this. Common law, the rule of the common law, the penal statute are strictly construed. It has no application to the criminal procedure statute of this state.
You know,
and Professor Arthur pointed out, while some courts have in effect closed their eyes to statutes abolishing the common law rule of strict construction, the Oregon Supreme Court has given the statute a liberal rather than a narrow construction. It is not intended that the draft should make any change in that regard.
We would sure cut down the room for appellate court legislation if we reimposed the common law rule that these things be strictly construed.
We can't do that. You fellow just created a new appellate court for this whole code, and you won't have anything for them to do.
You fellas.
I didn't vote.
Take it, Dan.
John is doubly Dan.
I don't think this, it's going to make a great deal of difference. This is, in essence, the language that the other new codes have. I don't think it's going to mean a lot. The principal thing, really, is that E, and then sub 2, that it'll be liberally construed. Not liberally construed to bring about a fair interpretation of what we've set forth.
What Tony's saying is that whether we put 2 in or not, the court's going to do what it darn well pleases.
Pretty much. But I don't see how anyone really can find too much objection to this. It's like the preamble.
God and motherhood, burning the weeds off the city lots, it's all in there.
I would move, though, that we go ahead and put E up.
I think that's
A.
Probably true.
You know, I got a letter from
the... Just have the rest of them follow in the regular order.
I was rather upset with the vote I did.
Do you understand the motion?
He signed it off.
The motion is
yours in God,
that E be placed at the top as A, and then all of the others will follow in the order in which they appear.
What difference does that make?
It really doesn't make a bit of difference, in my opinion. But it would show, when someone is reading this, that probably the thing that we had uppermost in our mind is the contents of E.
To ensure the public safety and to, by preventing commission of offenses.
I'd buy it up to that point, but then now I get into the argument of whether there is a deterrent influence of sentences.
Well, there, nobody can argue that there isn't.
But then you go on and talk about the rehabilitation of those convicted, and that should be prime in our consideration.
Well, our Constitution presently
limits us to that.
Is that? But I don't think it makes much difference.
Well, if there isn't any objection, I'll move the approval of...
Well, there's already a motion to place E at the top of the list. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion is carried. Burns moves its adoption as amended.
Second.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Carried. Now we can come to your definition.
Wow. We really moved to that. Probably come back to haunt us. So.
This Section 3 comes out of Subcommittee Number 1, Mr. Chairman.
With a majority of...
I move we approve it.
I second the motion.
Especially when it says a person is a human being.
Yeah.
We're thinking people in that subcommittee.
Did was the subcommittee chairman going to lead the discussion there?
No. You're doing great, Don.
Now, I should mention this, that the subcommittee recognized that we've got a little bit of a chicken or the egg problem with the list of definitions. We've tried to have at least a list that would include everything we could think of that should be defined for general application throughout the proposal revision. But if for no other reason, that it does give the draftsman some guidance in drafting the definition of specific crime. Up to now, before we had a draft on general definitions, we had made certain assumptions in line with general commission policy, and that was that with respect to definitions of terms, that generally we would be following, if not the exact language, at least the thrust of the definitions of the model penal code. But this does give us a list of definitions, seven terms that would have uniform meaning throughout the code, and with the realization that we may have to amend this, add to it, before we're through with this project. Now, under subsection 1, the definition of person is similar to our existing law, 161.010, subsection 11, which in effect includes corporations and partnerships and other entities within the definition of person.
And that farmers insurance.
And that,
when you go back to coercion, when you talk about corporate
association, you know,
the same thing apply to a corporation.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's not okay. All right,
yeah.
What's this you said? Coercing a corporation?
Well, I think there could be cases where you could perhaps coerce a corporation, but I don't think that this definition means that in every case it's either that it's a person and a corporation and this and that and the other thing. In some cases that these crimes could only apply to human beings. In other cases, they could only apply to corporations.
Yeah, and because we do leave not only the legislature but the courts out here, because it's going to allow them a chance to look at each case on its individual merits and each statute and try and that. That in drafting the specific crimes, so we felt such a section, such a definition would avoid the necessity of each time we draft a crime saying this applies to corporations.
Person, firm, or corporation,
yes.
Doing this or doing that.
Yeah.
Well, I think we improve on the present on the present definition of person. We were discussing just Thursday in subcommittee the applicability of crimes against corporations. Crimes by corporations, right. These would apply. A lot of these terms, like deadly physical force, deadly weapon, dangerous weapon, we've already discussed in commission meetings as they relate to robbery and burglary and some of the other substantive crimes. And I think the subcommittee was guided in large part in the adoption of these terms here by the discussions that we had in the full commission. We went over those.
As a matter of fact, these are the definitions that we used in
right.
drafting many of
That's
our
right.
substantive
That's right.
crimes.
They are.
So
the word is protracted. That's coming.
Yeah, that comes from the model penal code, I checked it.
Yeah.
Because we're really hung up on that one.
I thought it was a Paletism, but it isn't.
No.
So unless there are specific objections to any one of the definitions, I'd move the approval of section 3.
Considering its source, I'd say it was excellently done.
Yeah. Is there any further discussion on the motion? All in favor will say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion is carried.
Might be an interesting observation, Mr. Chairman, to notice that how fast things go that have been prepared by our Vice Chairman of the Commission.
Yeah.
And it might be interesting to have him prepare all the rest of them.
I move we approve agenda item 5, article 2.
Well, wait a
minute. I second the motion.
Oh, who's going to lead the discussion on that?
Well, this comes from the same subcommittee.
How come they get all the easy ones?
Burn selects them.
I know now why it's so important to the commission that we pay Chandler $150 a meeting to come over here.
Well, I would say this, that our culpability draft tries to do what we say we're going to do under our principles and purposes. We say that we're going to define the act and the accompanying mental state and to limit the condemnation of conduct when it's without fault. And that's what we've attempted to do under our culpability draft, to define our culpable mental state
as definition.
Intentionally, knowingly, recklessly, or criminal negligence. Now,
possess, exercise
criminal negligence, I'm sure that Professor Platts may want to have some comment on this. But the use of criminal negligence, we felt, and we tried to limit it and not generally have criminal negligence apply.
We both are.
And so in fact, we specifically said it's not going to apply unless it clearly appears by the wording of the statute defining the crime.
Usually, I don't see it in here. But it has a...
Maybe we don't go far
enough. Disputed.
Maybe we shouldn't have any section on that.
One has a greater...
Oh, I would say
This does not depart from the model criminal code that they provide for criminal negligence.
Absolutely. I think there's a definite need for a definition of criminal negligence. It has a place in the code. My objection is for that.
Now, of course, the real guts of this draft are your sections, your subsections 6,
there wouldn't be any
7, 8, 9, and 10.
Charging us both with possession, though, Tony.
No. No, I wasn't thinking of that.
These are terms that up to now we have been using in our drafts, assuming that they would have certain meanings. Now, this draft says what those meanings are. The model penal code uses the place of intentionally,
and I didn't.
They use purposely.
I think.
And
piece of farm machine.
We follow New York's proposal in that respect, which employs intentionally.
Don, on omission. And the other codes, I don't remember, I've read them too. Do they limit the failure to perform an act, performance of which is required by law? Or one has a, aren't there, some of them say, or one has a duty to perform? Aren't there criminal crimes, rather, that we have adopted which relate to the duty to perform rather than the requirement of law, requirement by law to perform?
This was raised in the subcommittee last Thursday, and I thought we should have some, even if we didn't. But the subcommittee outvoted me, and I went down in flames.
Well, that was on the question of accomplices, you mean?
Yeah. Other places where you had some kind of a duty that wasn't prescribed by statute. The general the impression seemed to be that that we ought to be pretty narrow and say what duties are that we expect people to perform. If we don't say them, why, we should leave it up to some district attorney or judge or somebody else to decide them.
Now, the model penal code states in this manner, liability for the commission of an offense may not be based on an omission unaccompanied by action unless the omission is expressly made sufficient by the law defining the offense, or a duty to perform the omitted act is otherwise imposed by law.
But isn't that broader than our definition? I don't know. I'm just thinking of some of the things where we might have a crime where there isn't any requirement by law that a certain act be performed, but there may be a requirement, I mean provision in our statute that is something short of a requirement that it be performed. I'm just asking, I don't remember anything offhand, but it seems to leave a gap to me as I look at it.
Well, I can't think of anything right on
here. Well, why did the model penal code then include sub A in its definition?
Purposely?
No, on look at your model penal code.
Yeah, page 14.
No.
Oh.
Page.
Oh. Page 13, 3A.
I think that's about it. Yes. Yeah.
I think what they're saying is that if the penal statute itself says that an omission or a failure to act constitutes a crime, that in those instances that will criminal liability will attach. Otherwise it won't. In other words, it would be on a section or a statute by statute basis, unless someplace else in the law, outside of the penal code, a duty is imposed upon a person to act.
And what you're saying then is that if elsewhere there is that duty imposed, then that constitutes a requirement by law, so it's included in this definition.
Yes, and the model penal code has, seems to me, just approach it from the other direction. We're saying that what an omission means in our definition of the term, the model penal code is saying that there's not going to be criminal liability for an omission unless one of these two things exists. The statute is specifically provided in the penal statute, or there's a duty of performance otherwise imposed. At least that's my understanding. The model penal code places omission in their culpability section. Term itself is not defined in that section. But it is defined
somewhat like a defense.
I don't know whether it's helpful or not, but I'd like to put it in the context of the actual facts that we're talking about here. There's a case of the situation of a mother who allows her children to starve to death in the attic. Omission.
Mm-hmm.
Charged with manslaughter, and the case decided that she could be held for manslaughter because she was under a legal duty of support. Therefore, there was a legal duty imposed upon that woman, which she omitted to do. You get into this, the very difficult areas where the man takes his mistress for the weekend to a hotel in Portland and allows her to die because she is a diabetic or something, and he does not call medical aid or a doctor, just simply does nothing. Well, the question then is under what kind of a duty is he under, legal or moral only? And the cases are kind of split on those situations where it comes up, but I think the definition here would be go along the lines of legal duty, wouldn't it, Don?
Yeah.
Yes.
And of course, I suppose you could possibly argue you're under a legal duty to your mistress, but I don't know. This is the kind of cases we're talking about.
Now, we discussed the same kind of cases in the subcommittee in connection with accomplices. And one provision in one of the sections which provided this was a means of by which you became an accomplice if you had a duty imposed upon you to prevent the commission of a crime. And we discussed the question, well, what kind of a duty? A legal duty, such as in the case of a peace officer or a sheriff's deputy or something like that, or whether there is some other duty that perhaps we're talking about. And we discussed the same hypothetical, question of a failure to provide support for a child or medical attention.
Just incidentally, this isn't abstract. On July 8th, I'll be arguing in the court Mary Davis, she's charged with murder by not providing medical attention for her child.
We had two cases in Lane County, the Pluard, State versus Pluard, the mother and father both were prosecuted for manslaughter because of neglecting a child.
I'm going to call her out.
Yeah,
I hope we can.
Davis, that's your presumption case. Okay, on the 9th, I argue. Maybe I'll come up and listen to it.
Yeah, maybe you can answer all the questions that they think of when I sit down.
Yeah. Maybe give time to gather my thoughts overnight. So. What time do I
have? I have four cases.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'll remove that we adopt articles, general principles of criminal liability, culpability.
Can I throw in a couple more comments before a vote is taken?
No reason to disturb the congregation.
Well, I might just have a little more discussion.
Well, these
are some certain sense extensions of the remarks I made earlier in the day. Preliminary draft number 3, which is not before us, which is one of the old replaced drafts, there was a section 5 which dealt with ignorance or mistake, and there is a note in the current draft for the subcommittee, as we mentioned, explaining why that was deleted. Here it is. Note gray ignorance or mistake as defense. This is on page 6 in your book. Preliminary draft number 4 on culpability. And it's read because it's very short. The Model Penal Code, New York Revised Penal Law, Michigan Revised Criminal Code, and the California draft, and I mentioned that there's a fairly good array of authority, contain sections relating to ignorance or mistake of fact or law as a defense. Preliminary draft number 3 included a similar section 5. The subcommittee, while not disagreeing with the legal proposition behind such a section, was of the opinion that the specific statute was probably unnecessary in view of the broad culpability provisions already formulated by the drafts. A factual mistake that supports a defense of justification was to be covered by separate articles. Now, omitted by choice of the commission then is an area that you are, by specific decision, leaving to the courts. And if you get some law made in the courts in this area that you don't like, I think it would be ill behoove any member of this commission to criticize a court for legislation. And this is an area where the court is going to have to legislate. I see no reason for adopting at least minimally,
you know,
the provisions in the Model Penal Code, Section 204, upon which we can all, I think, pretty well agree that, for instance, if a person acts after he has asked the district attorney whether he's violating the law, if he does something, and in fact does violate the law, we ought to be able to say in the statute that that's not a crime, that he's relying on the authority of one who's in charge of enforcing the law. Or if one asks the administrative agency in charge of enforcing a particular regulation, if what he is doing is in violation and he's told no, and in fact it is, why don't we say in the statute, rather than leaving it to the courts to decide? I think that I think we might all kind of agree that in these areas that a citizen ought to be able to rely on certain recognized authorities in the public agencies. And if he's told one thing, and it turns out to be that what he's done is really a violation, then he ought not to be held for it. Why don't we insert that kind of provision? The courts are going to have to decide it. Why let the courts do it when this is the legislative process that we're talking about here? There are other instances that perhaps are less agreeable to members of the commission, extending ignorance of mistake or ignorance of law in areas where you might not really want to extend it. Well, that's one question anyhow. I just simply would like to incorporate my earlier arguments by reference at this point with respect to defenses based on reasonable belief as contrasted with pure belief or pure belief or honest belief, if you want to call it that. I still object to that, but I lost that.
Well, with respect to the section on ignorance or mistake, I agree with you. I felt we should have one in there. That's why I put it in there in the earlier draft. I didn't go as far as California did, for example. And of course, California has really not agreed on it yet. There's a great deal of discussion and disagreement on the one provision with respect to reliance on.
Should we take 2 minutes? I think.
Which one was it? Well, on the official statement of the law. There's quite a disagreement. I don't think they've settled that.
And one not stated in here, it's often argued as a matter of policy, is how the ability of a person to rely on what his lawyer tells him, ought this to be an excuse when in fact his lawyer tells him the wrong thing with respect to the crime. That doesn't appear in the Model Penal Code. It's highly argumentative, I believe. There are other areas not covered. But I think there are some basic areas that we can pretty well agree on, and I see no reason for advocating here and letting the courts have to struggle with the problem and perhaps come up with an answer that we wouldn't like.
Would you go on after that then and say if his lawyer gave him bum advice and followed it and thereby was guilty of a crime, that he would be let off and the lawyer would be convicted?
Easy. Shall we take 10-minute break?
Fired, perhaps, and there are
recess, 10 minutes. On account of
criminal penalties of disbarment for giving bum advice?